Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading some articles from the April issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Grit and Glamour by CNI Editors. Her name is synonymous with glamour. She's often remembered as one of the biggest movie stars of the 20th century, sharing and often stealing scenes like from the likes of Paul Newman, Montgomery Clift, Lee Marvin, Rock Hudson, and James Dean. And yet, despite the formidable on-screen company she kept, we'd never considered the screen legend for the cover of our publication. Until now. Elizabeth Taylor, an icon, yes. A Western star? Not exactly. But when writer David Hofstede turned in his feature article on favorite Western romances, it dawned on us. What about Elizabeth Taylor in Giant? It was like daybreak. Of course, Elizabeth Taylor in Giant. With her co-stars Hudson and Dean, Taylor helped deliver an epic film adapted from a Pulitzer Prize-winning author Edna Ferber's novel, A Sprawling Tale, as many described it, that continues to resonate with audiences today. After it premiered in 1956, Giant earned 10 Academy Award nominations, including a second Best Director win for George Stevens. In her role as Leslie Benedict, the well-heeled Maryland-born wife of wealthy Texas rancher Jordan Bick Benedict Jr., Taylor leads viewers through this sweeping generational drama from her character's perspective. She is tender and yet stubborn, said one review in Variety at the time. A surprisingly clever performance that registers up and down the line. Taylor's star power and, dare we say, grit in Giant more than registers all these years later. It was an astonishing role for the then 23-year-old who would cinematically age 25 years over the course of the story, and the performance would become one of the most critically acclaimed of her career. It had staying power, and so do stills of her from the film and from the set. With her extraordinary beauty against the backdrop of dusty West Texas, those images continue to captivate to the point of breathlessness. There's plenty of substance, of course, under all the style, but what style? Martin Scorsese claims to have watched the film dozens of times. As far as filmmaking goes, he has been quoted, Giant is an inspiring film. I don't mean morally, but visually. It's all visual. While we wouldn't go so far as to say this edition of CNI is all visual, it is our annual style issue, and there's plenty of it in many forms. Liz's unforgettable look on the cover, Western fashion, modern interior design and indigenous runway looks, historic regalia, a musician's vintage wardrobe, and the vibrant outfits of Escaramuza Charas. British Vogue declared that Elizabeth Taylor remains one of Hollywood's most enduring style icons. We couldn't agree more. And we'd like to keep the conversation going. Who are your style icons? Who would you like to see on the cover? What are some of your favorite stylish and romantic westerns? Write to us at letters@cowboysindians.com to let us know. Because sharing our stories about the West and our love for this singular place and state of mind will never go out of style. Romancing the West. Start with a giant portion of epic West Texas drama, then load up on plenty more westerns where love rules the range. a giant of a Western. Elizabeth Taylor, Rock Hudson, and James Dean star in George Stevens' beloved Western drama, going deep into the three R's of the epic Texas tale, Riata, relationships, and the complicated romance of the West. He's an unapologetically alpha male Texan, owner of a cattle ranch large enough to make John Dutton jealous, and accustomed to women, except for his domineering sister, and Mexican laborers knowing their place. She is a strong-willed Maryland socialite with progressive opinions, especially when it comes to the exploitation of Mexican laborers, and an independent streak wider than a country mile. By the way, she knows next to nothing about cattle, ranching, or Texas, so of course they're made for each other, right? In the world according to giant director George Stevens' classic film, 1956, based on Edna Ferber's best-selling 1952 novel, opposites instantly attract, marry hastily, and maintain ties strong enough to withstand sporadic disputes over the course of decades together, despite a few months of estrangement. And because the unlikely partners are charismatically portrayed by Elizabeth Taylor and Rock Hudson, audiences have continued to have a rooting interest in the preservation of their union for as long as the movie has been available for viewing on screens large and small. Covering a period from the 1920s to post-World War II years, Giant is a sprawling and spectacular saga that focuses on the intersecting lives of Jordan Bick Benedict, Jr., Rock Hudson, the tradition-bound owner of the Riata Ranch, a massive spread of around a half million acres in West Texas, Leslie Linton Benedict, Elizabeth Taylor, his Maryland-born wife, whom Bick meets cute while he's in her area on a horse buying trip, and who gradually acclimates herself to the rigors of Texas ranch life, but never fully accepts the casual racism directed at Mexican laborers and neighbors, or ingrained sexism of her husband and his good old boy buddies, and Jet Rink, James Dean, a moodily insolent ranch hand who has bequeathed a small patch of land by Bick's spinster sister, Luz Mercedes McCambridge, becomes a millionaire when he strikes oil on his property and nurses a serious crush on Leslie, who, it should be noted, does not deliberately encourage his attention. Yes, it's true, Giant is at heart an epic love story, but it's also a tale of a romantic triangle. Slowly but surely, with a good deal of prodding by his wife, Bick becomes a better and more racially enlightened person, especially after his son, Jordan Benedict III, Dennis Hopper, marries a Mexican-American beauty, Juana, Elsa Cardenas, and fathers Jordan Benedict IV. But Jet, a character Edna Ferber modeled after real Texas oil tycoon Glenn McCarthy, is never fully satisfied after amassing his immense fortune and continues to nurture his unrequited love for Leslie, even after he starts to woo her daughter, Carol Baker. Sigmund Freud likely would have had a field day with that love story. 6 decades after its initial release, Giant can be viewed as a strong influence on everything from the primetime soap opera Dallas, both the original and the reboot, and Dynasty, which briefly featured Rock Hudson as a series regular, to movies as diverse as Kevin Reynolds' Fandango, in which young Kevin Costner and some friends visit Marfa, Texas, to see the crumbling remains of the Riata Ranch house set, to Robert Altman's Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean. Dean died in an auto crash less than a week after completing his work on Giant, During post-production, director Stevens employed actor Nick Adams to overdub some of Dean's dialogue. And nowhere is it treasured more than in the Lone Star State, where it remains known as the national film of Texas. The reason for its enduring appeal? As Don Graham notes in his indispensable book, Cowboys and Cadillac, How Hollywood Looks at Texas, the moral equation of Giant is the most sentimental and cherished in Texas mythology, a preference for the ranching tradition as against the wheeler-dealer world of wildcatters and gushers. As a modern Western, Giant succeeded so well because it affirmed for Texans and for the nation the old-fashioned virtues of pastoral ranching, cowboying, yes-mamming and no-mamming, and raising prize-winning cattle on the open plains. At the same time, though, Giant also takes a wider view of life and love by celebrating long-term marriage as one of life's great adventures. Under ordinary circumstances, Bick and Leslie probably would have had nothing to do with each other. And even if they did, well, the initial spark of romance would burn out pretty quickly. But let's face it, we generally don't watch movies to see ordinary people do ordinary things. And you rarely find a couple more extraordinary than Elizabeth Taylor and Rock Hudson in Giant. Love and the Odor. Do love and cowboys mix? They do in these rootin', tootin', shootin', and smoochin' westerns. By David Hofstede. In one of their many film appearances together, Roy Rogers kissed his wife and co-star Dale Evans on the forehead. After that, the studio received sacks of letters telling them to leave the mushy stuff out. Such is the dilemma of romance in westerns. Many of the classics may offer a love story as a subplot, Ringo and Dallas in Stagecoach, Wyatt Earp and Clementine in My Darling Clementine, Sundance and Etta, and maybe Butch in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. However, many fans don't care if the hero gets the girl as long as the bad guy winds up face down in the mud. But romance devotees need not avoid the genre altogether. Here are some movies with love stories at the forefront, with or without the mushy stuff. The Cowboy and the Lady. Can a hard-partying Florida society girl find lasting happiness with a humble, slow-talking rodeo cowboy? A romantic comedy like The Cowboy and the Lady wouldn't have it any other way. Although it takes a mismatched couple a while to get there, 90 minutes to be exact. Gary Cooper plays Stretch Willoughby, who is set up on a blind date with Mary Smith, Merle Oberon. During their time together, she pretends to be a maid with a tragic past instead of a wealthy socialite. Stretch is so moved that the next day he proposes marriage. She quickly turns him down, and he tosses her in a swimming pool. But truths are revealed eventually, along with true feelings, in this breezy culture clash yarn. Colorado Territory. Unrequited love is certainly the most painful kind of all, and Roald Walsh's Colorado Territory explores three such tragic romances amidst a fast-paced story about escaped outlaw Wes McQueen, Joel McRae, hoping to retire after one last train robbery. During a stagecoach trek to reunite with his former boss, Wes meets Julianne, Dorothy Malone, who has moved west with her father to start a new life. He is attracted to her, but her father tells Wes that her heart belongs to Randolph, who refuses to marry her. While Wes pines for the love and for the better life she represents, his gang of bandits is joined by Colorado Carson, Virginia Mayo, a half-Indian woman who falls for him. Does anyone get a happy ending? Sadly, not in this remake of High Sierra, also directed by Walsh. Calamity Jane. The most famous historical Old West romance was that of Wild Bill Hickok and Calamity Jane, though many historians doubt the relationship ever extended beyond flirtation. But it makes for a great story, one that inspired several films, including The Plainsman in 1936 and Wild Bill, 1995. Calamity Jane sets the romance to music, with Doris Day as a titular heroine and Howard Keel as Hickok. While both pursue other relationships for most of the film, they finally acknowledge their true feelings in time for a wedding before the closing credits. Keel, having already played the Frank Butler in Annie Get Your Gun, seemed right at home in a Western musical romance, and the always ladylike Doris Day is, somewhat surprisingly, delightful as a frontier wildcat in buckskins. And who could forget Doris singing the sublime Oscar-winning hit, Secret Love? Oklahoma. Musicals lend themselves more naturally to romance than westerns, so it's not surprising to find that cowboys who sing and dance are more likely to fall in love. The landmark 1943 stage musical Oklahoma was adapted into an equally impressive film featuring an iconic Oscar-winning score by Rodgers and Hammerstein. The choreography of Agnes DeMille was revolutionary for its time, particularly in the dream ballet that dramatizes the remote romance between Lori, Shirley Jones, and ranch hand Curly, Gordon McRae, which is complicated by Curly's brutish rival, Judd, played by Rod Steiger. Dances with Wolves. There are many reasons why Dances with Wolves is a very special film, from its authentic portrayal of the culture and language of the Lakota Sioux to director star Kevin Costner's determination to make the movie his way. While it is primarily a redemption tale in which Army officer John Dunbar finds a new and better life among the Lakota, it is the romance between Dunbar and the native woman Stands with a Fist, Mary McDonnell, that gives the story its heart. In the film's final moments, as they head off together after so many harrowing encounters with Pawnees and soldiers, viewers undoubtedly hoped they were riding toward a happy ending. While author Michael Blake's sequel to Dances with Wolves was never filmed, the story does reveal that the couple stayed together and became parents to three children, until the world outside their tribe once again came calling. Legends of the Fall. Samuel Henry Thomas returns to the remote Montana ranch of his father, Anthony Hopkins, with his fiancée Susanna, Julia Ormond. When Susanna's eyes lock with Samuel's older brother Tristan, Brad Pitt, a mutual passion is ignited, but Susanna ends up marrying a third brother, Alfred, Aidan Quinn. It's not as sordid as it sounds, though the melodrama label is not as easily avoided. Still, Ormond is captivating. Pitt proved he's more than a handsome face, and John Toll's photography deservedly won an Oscar. How does it end? Fans still debate whether they got it right, but the death of Tristan's eventual bride and mother of his children, Isabel II, Karina Lombard, adds yet another element of romantic tragedy that's almost Shakespearean. The Horse Whisperer. Sometimes what an audience wants to happen between a man and a woman in love does not come to pass because of complications that are too formidable for honorable people to ignore, such as the fate of Montana rancher Tom Booker, Robert Redford, whose unique affinity with horses brings him to the attention of New Yorker Annie McLean, Kristen Scott Thomas. Annie's daughter Grace, Scarlett Johansson, was seriously injured and traumatized after a riding accident, and her horse has become uncontrollable. While Tom uses his gifts to heal horse and rider, he and Annie fall in love, but Annie is already married. love and loss unfold amid stunning cinematography, and director Redford's keen eye for framing both wide-open vistas and achingly intimate moments. The movie ends with a close-up of Tom as he silently watches Annie and Grace leave for New York. As one reviewer correctly observed, everything his character is feeling at that moment is perfectly revealed on his face. Open Range. As one IMDb review states, Open Range doesn't do anything particularly new, it just does it particularly well. That's a familiar refrain in both memorable westerns and classic romances. There may be only so many ways to tell these stories, but when you pair Kevin Costner, who also directs, and Annette Bening, both at their movie star prime, as two people not looking for love but finding something in each other they never expected, it's an excursion well worth taking again. Set in 1880s Montana, the film has both tenderness and violence. Its intensely realistic wide-shot gunfight scenes won critical praise and its R rating. The hostilities might be central, but so is the attraction between Charlie Waite, Costner, and Sue Barlow, Bening. Their hesitant romance blossoms gradually, like everything else in this leisurely paced tale. Waite, an ex-gunslinger turned cowhand, and his boss, Robert Duvall, run afoul of a ruthless cattle baron. A conflict that cannot be resolved will compel Charlie, like Alan Ladd in Shane, to return to the violent trade he hoped to escape. It takes a while before the shooting starts, but scenes such as the awkward but endearing moment when Sue serves Charlie tea will keep you engaged until the guns are drawn. The Longest Ride. You can't go wrong with Eastwood in a western. Okay, in this case it's Scott Eastwood, but Clint's son looks as good as a cowboy as his dad did when he was heading them up and moving them on in Rawhide. Romance enters the picture when he drops his hat at a rodeo and is picked up by a sophisticated Jersey girl, Sophia, Britt Robertson, who will soon be off to Manhattan to study art history. While it seems like fate is against them, a chance encounter with an elderly man who has loved and lost, well played by Alan Alda, may inspire the young couple to give their love a chance. If this sounds like a Western version of The Notebook, that's not surprising, as The Longest Ride was adapted from a story by Notebook author Nicholas Sparks. It's a sweet and predictable tale that might be a little too Hallmark Channel for more cynical viewers. You know who you are. Slow West. In the wrong hands, this story might not have worked at all. Indeed, some critics shared that assessment. Unintentionally ridiculous was the verdict of the RogerEbert.com website. But others were swept up in the adventure of baby-faced youth Jay, Cody Smith McPhee, braving the many hazards of an American Old West to find the woman he loves, Karen Pistorius, after she is unfairly exiled from her homeland. True, the kid looks like he wouldn't last 10 seconds in Tombstone or Dodge City, so thankfully writer-director John McLean provides a guide in Silas, a tough hombre played by Michael Fassbender, who is one of those actors who automatically make any movie better. The result is not a typical Western or a typical romance. Even the backdrop of New Zealand substituting for Colorado seems more than a bit off. But this works on you slowly and steadily until you'll be as eager as Jay to find out if his continent-spanning quest of love will be rewarded. Lee Marvin. The beloved actor known for his tough guy portrayals would have turned 100 this year. By Joe Layden. During his decades-long career in film and television, Lee Marvin played everything from a badass Chicago cop in the 1957-60 TV series M-Squad, to the demanding leader of convicts pressed into service for a guerrilla mission in The Dirty Dozen, to the quick guilt-racked traveling salesman Hickey in John Frankenheimer's film of Eugene O'Neill's The Iceman Cometh. But as we celebrate his centennial, he was born February 19, 1924 in New York City, we remain most impressed by Marvin's work in Westerns. Here are some of the late Oscar winner's best efforts in the genre. Seven Men from Now, 1956. Director Bud Bottecher gave Marvin a major visibility-raising career boost by casting him as Bill Masters, the untrustworthy friend-enemy of the vengeful man, Randolph Scott, hunting the bandits who killed his wife while robbing a Wells Fargo freight station. As Bottecher wrote in his memoir, he and screenwriter Burt Kennedy agreed that Western heavies over the years had been portrayed as much too heavy. They rode black horses and wore black hats. You never saw anything good about any of them. Well, we set out to make our villains extremely attractive. Sure, they were going to get killed, eventually, by our hero, but we wanted our audience to really love them while they were still kicking. Twilight Zone, The Grave, 1961. 1 year before he engaged in outlawry with Lee Van Cleef and Strother Martin, Marvin appeared opposite those cult fave character actors in one of the spookiest Old West episodes ever to air as part of Rod Sterling's iconic anthology series. He played Connie Miller, a gunman who arrives in a small town too late to kill a bothersome bad guy that the townspeople had commissioned him to eliminate. Before his untimely demise, the bad guy promised to rise up and grab Miller if the latter ever visited his grave. Martin conveys equal measures of braggadocio and trepidation as Miller is more or less shamed into accepting the challenge. Nothing good comes of this. The Comancheros, 1961. Martin proved to be the perfect match for John Wayne in the final film directed by Hollywood great Michael Curtiz, Casablanca. Wayne played Jake Cutter, a Texas ranger on the trail of white renegades, Comancheros, who are selling liquor and guns to the marauding Comanche. Lee Marvin, wrote the film critic for the showbiz trade paper Variety, makes a vivid impression in a brief but colorful role as a half-scalped, vile-tempered Comanchero agent. We agree. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, 1962. John Wayne and James Stewart star as, respectively, a straight-shooting hero and a tenderfoot lawyer in director John Ford's last great Western, but Marvin steals every scene that isn't bolted to the floor as Liberty Valance, an outlaw who, with a little help from minions played by Strother Martin and Lee Van Cleef, rules a frontier town with a whim of iron. In his book, Lee Marvin, Point Blank, biographer Duane Epstein aptly wrote, "When Marvin took the stage as Ford directed, the actor obliterated any previous image of a villain in a John Ford opus. In just a handful of riveting scenes, he conveyed the anger, maliciousness, and sadism of a man who symbolized all the lawlessness in the Old West, and who refused to step gently aside to encroaching civilization." Cat Ballou, 1965. Much like when John Wayne finally won his long-overdue Academy Award by kinda sorta spoofing himself in True Grit, Marvin brought home the gold for his hilariously self-satirical portrayal of Kid Shalene, a hard-drinking gunman who moderates his alcohol intake just long enough to help the titular schoolteacher-turned-outlaw, Jane Fonda, avenge the murder of her rancher father. Marvin also played Shalene's brother, tin-nosed hired killer Tim Strawn, but that guy wasn't funny at all. The most famous image in Cat Ballou, Shalene and his equally drunken horse leaning against a wall at an inopportune time, continues to amuse as an internet meme. But the funniest scene in this very funny comic western involves Shalene's enthusiastic but inopportune singing of Happy Birthday. The Professionals, 1966. Marvin is at his steely-eyed, take-no-BS best in writer-director Richard Brooks' classic as Henry Fardan, the leader of uniquely talented mercenaries. Burt Lancaster, Robert Ryan, and Woody Strode are others, hired by a wealthy rancher, Ralph Bellamy, to retrieve his wife, Claudia Cardinal, who's been kidnapped by a Mexican revolutionary, Jack Palance. Even after they discover that the wife wasn't really kidnapped, the mercenaries persist in their mission because, well, professionals do the job they're paid to do. There are some amusing moments of comic relief as characters trade wisecracks, insults, and other barbed remarks. But Marvin also conveys a moral dimension without seeming preachy and an impatience with stupidity without being short-tempered. When Bellamy asks if he has any objections to working with a Negro, Marvin waits a few seconds before speaking, but his expression is easy to read. What the hell kind of a damn fool question is that? When he finally does speak, he pointedly ignores Bellamy's query because there are far more important matters to discuss. Paint Your Wagon, 1969. Marvin really never had another role quite like Ben Rumson, a hearty and boozy prospector given to wanderlust, bouts of melancholy, and singing. Critics initially were unkind to director Joshua Logan's lavish adaptation of the 1951 Broadway musical by Alan J. Lerner and Frederick Lowe about a singular romantic triangle. Clint Eastwood and Gene Seberg played the other parties involved in a mining boomtown during the California Gold Rush. Over the years since its theatrical release, however, audiences have warmed to the movie and to Marvin's sly balance of boisterous silliness and poignant seriousness. And yes, they've also come to enjoy Marvin's gravelly rendition of the song Wanderin' Star, which actually was a UK Top 40 hit in 1970. Monty Walsh, 1970. Marvin gave one of his finest performances, not one of his finest performances in a Western, but one of his finest performances, period, in this autumnal drama based on a novel by Jack Schaefer, who wrote Shane, about two aging cowboys, Monty Walsh, Marvin, and Chet Rollins, Jack Palance, who reluctantly acknowledge that their way of life is drawing to a close. The film also is notable for giving Marvin his first and only opportunity to have a true romantic relationship on camera with legendary French actress Jeanne Moreau, perfectly cast as a prostitute and saloon girl with serious health issues. There have long been rumors that the romance continued off-camera for the couple, but neither ever commented publicly on their relationship. For the record, however, Moreau did compliment her co-star in a 1974 review. He says more in less words, sometimes in no words at all, than any other American actor I've ever met. True enough. Wine Country Wonder. with dazzling elevated seasonal fare, its well-being to the max at Napa's stylish and sustainable Stanley Ranch. By Wolf Schneider. California's Napa Valley is famed for its viny culture and gastronomic heights, this being the land of the $5,000-plus Screaming Eagle Sauvignon Blanc and Thomas Keller's The French Laundry. Newly constructed on the rolling hills of a former cattle ranch, the sumptuous Stanley Ranch Auberge Resorts collection fits right in. Its modern farmhouse structures are set among silvery olive and eucalyptus trees, rows of fragrant lavender, vineyards growing Chardonnay and Pinot Noir varietals, and a garden geared for its innovative farm-to-table restaurant, Bear. Opened in 2022, Stanley Ranch is where you want to go for the absolute best. It's where I am for a three-day girlfriend's getaway with my pal Sharona. From the moment we pull up at the valet stand and hear the Americana country playlist with tunes by Chris Stapleton and Zach Bryan, we're blissed out. This opulent and earthy place hits all the right notes. The stand is staffed by valets called ranch hands. They're wearing cowboy hats, denim, and cowboy boots. The guests sport sundresses and suede. Leather medallioned bracelets serve as the room keys. Not far from the quietly elegant accommodations, steers graze. We arrive a little early for check-in. Okay, like 10 a.m. early. When you stay at Stanley Ranch, you want to make the most of it. We could walk or bike the winding trails, but a hawk walk begins now, and that's where we head. Falconer Rebecca Rosen trains the hawks, falcons, and owls that help to keep pest birds from the property's vineyards. Rosen is at the ready with a big leather glove, some chicken morsels, and a softly feathered brown hawk with a yellow beak named Eddie. I extend a gloved arm toward Eddie, who's perched atop a nearby pole. Rosen calls out, "Eddie! Eddie!" He swoops down to scarf up the chicken on my glove. Then he remains there, peacefully perched. He's just bigger than a pigeon and weighs about as much as a can of Coke. They're trained with positive reinforcement. It's all his decision to come. "We need to be very, very calm when they fly to us," Rosen says. Joining us on the hawk walk is a well-mannered family with triplet boys, a girl named Blake, and a beautiful blonde mom who mutters something about being in Qatar for the World Cup. Later, I realize she's Allie Wagner, a former World Cup soccer star who's now a television analyst. She's also a prototypical Stanley Ranch guest, along with Tour de France bicyclists and NBA and NFL players. Athletes are drawn to the spa, recovery circuit, and fitness center up on the hill, where there's a monumental Infinity Symbol sculpture by Gordon Hoother. There's a hyperbaric oxygen chamber for increasing oxygen levels, cold plunge for resetting pain and endurance levels, salt room igloo for purification and negative ions, lymphatic drainage machine, sauna, steam room, outdoor pools, and an array of yoga classes, massages, and facials, along with experiences like mountain lion tracking, fishing on the Napa River, and stargazing at blood moons. Us, once we leave Eddie and get settled into our fabulous accommodations, we groove on the restorative yoga class, cryotherapy facial, chlorophyll water, candied ginger, and super goop SPF lip screen shine. Progressive design entices in the 135 guest rooms and suites like ours, with open layouts featuring cream-toned linen couches, vaulted ceilings, wall-mounted control panels, sliding glass walls opening to private patios with fire pits, and expansive bathrooms with luxurious outdoor showers. Polished natural wood abounds, along with leather, glass, and exposed stone. Extended suites are available at the villas, where there's even a partial ownership plan. There's a lot to experience here across the 700 rolling acres, but at the end of a glorious day, everyone ends up at the incomparable golden-hued Bear. With its slanted ceiling, huge tumbleweed-inspired bouquets of dried flowers, and earthy wood-burning stove, the restaurant is the territory of charismatic executive chef Anthony Stagnaro, known for his wood-fire grilling, fermenting, and making sure guests, who include celeb couples like Steph and Ayesha Curry, he's with the NBA, she's with the Food Network, get one of the best meals of their lives. How does Stagnaro characterize his inspired cuisine? Elemental, he says. We like to focus on one ingredient. If it's a carrot, we like to focus on the best carrot, the best ribeye. How to make it the best? We do a lot with fermenting. My craft cocktail, dubbed the Wanderer, is Bear's take on the Negroni. It has apple-infused gin, thyme-infused Campari, and vermouth. Its smoothness is perfection. Oh, here comes the cuisine. There are delectable preserved baby farm vegetables with cashew miso dip, Asian-influenced crispy rice with Thai chili, lightly fried maitake mushrooms with an eggplant, fermented pepper, za'atar, and local olive oil accompaniment that's to die for, wood-grilled Mount Lassen whole rainbow trout, and huckleberry barbecued quail. For dessert, the only at Bear scrumptious sourdough ice cream made from a 78-year-old starter with caramel sauce. It's insane. It's a must. We stroll back to our arbor cottage on a dark country path under starry skies and promptly follow at Bear Napa and at Anthony underline Nicholas underline Stagnaro on Instagram. It will have to do until our next visit, and there will be one. Pride of Place. A jet-setting photographer leaves the bright lights of the big city for the Marfa ghost lights and creates a home base that celebrates both the minimalist landscape and more-is-more decor. By Laura Castelny. Douglas Friedman was always destined to live a big life. The jet-setting photographer just happens to do it from a small West Texas town, population 1,750, located about 200 miles from the closest major airport. Granted, the town is Marfa, the high desert home of the famed Ghost Lights, a Prada installation that's become a must-snap for every single Instagram influencer, and a cavalcade of respected artists such as sculptor and painter Donald Judd, plein air painter Rex Straw Downs, and digital drawer Jeff Elrod. For Friedman, coming home to the middle of nowhere has become a much-needed respite after crisscrossing the world. "I'm always sad to leave and so excited to come back," he says. Marfa is what you make of it. You can be totally solitary or a total party monster. I'm a proud Texan now, and I love the way the town is always evolving and changing. Moving to the Lone Star State was never part of the plan. Friedman grew up on New York City's Upper West Side in the 1980s. As a college freshman, he went west and studied anthropology and documentary filmmaking at Occidental College. Post-graduation, he stayed in L.A. to work for director David Fincher on high-profile films like Seven, Fight Club, and The Game. It was amazing, but after 2.5 or 3 years, I realized I'd never be able to make anything that amazing on my own, he says. Rather than settle for less, he sold everything and headed away east, the Far East, taking pictures as he backpacked through India and climbed the Himalayas. When I came back, I needed work. An ex of mine got me a job as a photographer's assistant, and I realized I could actually build a career and earn a good living doing this, he says. I gave myself 4 years to apprentice and tried to learn everything I could about shooting high fashion, catalogs, interiors, you name it. All the hard work paid off. Friedman became a top fashion photographer before pivoting his focus to shooting interiors for noted designers and swanky shelter magazines, including LA Decor, Architectural Digest, and Veranda. I guess you could say I fell into photography after falling out of other things, he says. All I knew was I never was going to be a lawyer, much to my parents' disappointment. But ultimately, photography chose me. The same could be said about Marfa. The first time Friedman visited, he couldn't understand what all the fuss was about. We were there from Sunday to Tuesday, and everything was closed. It was somehow raining, humid, and hot all at the same time. Still, he couldn't quite shake thoughts of West Texas, in part because it was such a hot topic on the East Coast. I went to Martha Stewart's birthday party, and she was talking about how much she loved Martha, and then all the other guests joined in. I decided it was a sign. After some Googling, Friedman launched an in-real-life search for land. I spent the day with my beautiful real estate broker, Mary Farley, but I wasn't seeing anything that I was falling in love with, and I wanted to fall in love, he says. Farley attempted a Hail Mary on a drive a mile outside of town. We passed a double-wide trailer on blocks, a few derelict cars, a goat farm, and some rodeo cowboys. Then the road just ended on this incredible property overlooking endless grasslands and mountains. That was it. A few days later, the photographer had an accepted offer and a modest plan for a residence on his personal plot. Originally, it was going to be a trailer. I was researching Airstreams, and I imagined something very Raising Arizona. But even for that, I needed infrastructure, water, power, sewage. That kind of investment warranted something more substantial. Because Friedman wanted something super symmetrical, low maintenance, sturdy, and not at all precious, the solution turned out to be a state-of-the-art modular system. After working with a New York City-based architect, he made his specifications and awaited delivery of loads of glulam timbers, steel connectors, and structural insulated panels. Then he waited patiently while contractor Billy Margineaux led the charge to assemble all on site. In addition to all the laminated timber and heavy metals, there were plenty of glass deliveries as well. Every wall is glass. It's definitely the type of house where you wake up with the sunrise, explains Freeman. The open floor plan really encourages a sense of community and encourages you to be present with the people in the house. When it came time to furnish the approximately 2,000 square foot, 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom house, Friedman leaned into a Donald Judd-inspired minimalism for both aesthetic and financial reasons. After I built the house, I had no money, so it was all so random. There were mattresses on pallets and gourmet coffee tables, but it was all I had to work with, he says. But as he began refilling his coffers, an affinity for maximizing returned. I thought it would be interesting to be a minimalist, but I didn't survive it. To create a more-is-more show place, Friedman relied on his years of experience photographing the homes of the rich and famous, his relationships with magazine editors, and his personal Rolodex of interior designer friends like Ken Fulk, Bridget Romanek, and Stephen Gambrell. He asked questions, begged for advice, and began layering in a mix of fun finds sourced locally in New York and via the Future Perfect. He worked with VIP to design and install a kitchen that doesn't feel like a kitchen. He even hung de Gournay wallpaper in the guest room. It's my homage to Liz Taylor in Giant, he notes. Friedman also began building an art collection composed of works produced in Marfa by Marfa artists or with some other connection to Marfa. I worked closely with the curators at Ballroom Marfa and Jenny Moore, formerly of the Chinati Foundation, advised me on pieces too, he says. I don't know a lot, so it was very important to rely heavily on my friends to get my collection going. While Friedman says he made mistakes along the way, he knows he nailed the home's most important asset, the views. No matter where you are, whether you're surrounded by these incredibly special and commanding things like de Gournay wallpaper and Kyle Bunting rugs, nothing detracts from the views, he says. It was an accident, but it totally worked out. A Romance of Old California. The Ramona Outdoor Play, based on a novel by early Native rights activist Helen Hunt Jackson, has been performed in Southern California for more than 100 years. By Mark Bedore. Appalled at the treatment of American Indians, popular 19th century poet and writer Helen Hunt Jackson became an activist, using her pen to fight for Native rights. A Massachusetts native, she was a classmate and lifelong friend of Emily Dickinson, and her poetry was admired, read aloud, and anthologized by the Ralph Waldo Emerson. But what really put the fire in Jackson's heart and pen was an 1879 lecture in Boston by Ponca chief Standing Bear about the forcible removal of the Ponca from Nebraska. She sent a copy of her 1881 book, A Century of Dishonor, something like a 19th century Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, to every member of Congress. But the book and its message were largely ignored. However, her second try, the novel Ramona, was a hit. Set during the turmoil surrounding the American takeover of California after the Mexican-American War, it told the story of the doomed love affair between an American Indian and a mixed-race young woman raised on a Spanish rancho. Then I thought if I could write a story so interesting that people could not put it down and weave into that story the true history of some of the Indians' sufferings, I might thus, as St. Paul says, perhaps convince some, Jackson said. Her reform message might have read as a love story between the fictional Ramona and Alessandro, but the native history Jackson portrayed as was based on actual events in Southern California in the 1870s and 80s. First published in 1884, Ramona has been reprinted 3 times and been made into a movie 5 times. In 2023, it celebrated its 100th year of performances as an annual outdoor play in Hemet, California's beautiful Ramona Bow. Jackson, who died soon after Ramona was published, would never know the impact her book and its spinoff, California's Official Outdoor Play, would have to this very day. How wonderful it would be to be able to go back, says Ramona actress DeBroden Shockey, and say, Miss Jackson, you changed hearts and minds. And we're still doing it now because it still needs to be told. Performed in a natural amphitheater constructed specifically for the first production in 1923, the Ramona pageant features a cast of hundreds, including dancers, musicians, and about a dozen cowboys on horseback. And while the play clearly portrays the troubled times of the day, it also celebrates California's native, Spanish, and pioneer heritage. The fun part of it all is all the cowboys and shooting and horses, says Eli Santana, who plays the doomed Alessandro. The late Raquel Welch once starred in the pageant as Ramona in 1959, as did Ann Archer in 1969. There have been many film treatments of the novel. W.D. Griffith in 1910 with Mary Pickford, made with Ada Gleason in 1916, and with Loretta Young in 1936. The 1928 film, silent film, Ramona, directed by Chickasaw filmmaker Edwin Carey and starring Dolores del Rio, was considered lost until it was rediscovered in Prague in 2010 and restored by the Library of Congress. Performed every year in Hemet, Ramona is America's longest-running outdoor play. A largely volunteer effort, the pageant commemorated its centennial milestone in 2023 with the dedication of a literary landmark for Jackson. Every spring, for several days in April and May, her famous love story unfolds in the amphitheater, its message still apropos more than a century later.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.